My name is Nell, and I'm the old Al-Anon that Harlan keeps introducing you to. I'm a very grateful member of this program. And April the 3rd of the 10th, I came to my first meeting of Al-Anon. And it, I really wasn't there for the right reasons, but I stayed. I kept coming back. And that's why I have 53 years. I'm not dead yet. I just keep coming back. So. Thank you so much for asking me. I love this part of the country, and I love the people in it. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love Al-Anon. How many AAs are here? Whoa! Oh, wow! I'll be telling you why I love you later. But thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming. How many Al-Anons? Good. Hey, the AAs have you beat. What's wrong with you? And I hope there's someone new here today. And I'm going to tell you why. Newcomers tell me something every time I go to a meeting. I went to a meeting with Lori last Tuesday night, and a young lady was called on to participate, and she said, "This is my second meeting, but I'll be glad to do what you ask. I'm willing to do what you ask. Just guide me." Wow! I thought that was profound. It took me 3 years. Her second meeting. And another meeting I went to one time, I heard a young lady say, after a program on forgiveness, "I think I can go home with a spirit of forgiveness." And I thought, the key to this program is the spirit in which we do it. So, you young ones, don't ever think that you don't have something to give. Well, I want to thank Cliff and Laura. They're my caregivers this weekend. I went to their house Tuesday night, and gave them all the tips on my medications, and I take Prilosec. As for acid reflux, for those of you who don't know. And at the airport, I had assistance, and I love it. I love getting in that wheelchair. Pat and Cliff kind of like those perks, too. I mean, excuse me, Lori and Cliff kind of like those perks. Pat Roach is my sponsor, so sometimes I say Cliff and think of Pat. It's not easy to walk across the street with Lori either. You know, I know I'm up in years, but when I see good-looking guys walking toward me, I smile. But you know who they looked at? I want to say, this isn't gray, it's blonde. But, oh, I love the feeling in these rooms. I like the way you sound. I like the whole warmth, welcoming, and love that I feel here. Turn that back on. I want to look at them. Some of them sleep. I have a son that falls asleep in church, and the preacher said something to him. He said, "I wasn't asleep, Karen. I was praying." So some of you may pray a lot this afternoon. Yeah. You know, you wonder sometimes, when I hear someone like Larsine, and then think of my own life growing up, I think, How'd she ever make it? I didn't grow up in that kind of home. I had a loving home. Alcohol was never a problem in my home. In fact, alcohol was never in my home, except when Daddy's brother came. And he married five times, and every time he had a new wife, he came up and brought a six-pack. And they had what is called a Dutch lunch. I guess that was their wedding brunch or something. I don't know. But we always looked forward to Uncle Mutt coming with a new wife. It added a little spice to our life. But I was an only child for about 6 and a half years. And my parents adored me, absolutely adored me, and I knew it. And the only thing that ever gave me any trouble was the word no. And since Mother was a disciplinarian, I couldn't do anything about her no's, but I could change my Daddy's no's to yes's with a little eyelash energy and a tear. It's more pitiful if you just have one tear trickling down, like you're trying to keep from it. And you know that worked with, or I tried to make that work with alcoholism too, but it didn't. It just didn't, even though I was pitiful. I miss Cleve. Speaking of being pitiful, I miss Cleve. I miss him a lot. He died 5 years ago, and he told me to never say that, you know, how some of these flowery obituaries come out, like so-and-so walked into the arms of Jesus. So he said, don't ever write anything like that about me. Just say I died, okay? So I remembered that. And watching Cliff and Lori this weekend reminds me a little bit how it used to be for Cleve and I. And, you know, there's a time for all things, and I know that. And there's this old saying about not crying because it's over, but be grateful it happened. But I miss seeing that guy down on the front row when I shared. And I loved it when he was there because I thought that he ought to hear how much I suffered. Didn't faze him a bit. So my story would get better each time. I told a little more. I was born during the Depression, and I don't remember doing without a great deal. We were not, we didn't have a lot of money, but my dad had a job as a rule. And if I got one real authentic Shirley Temple dress a year, I had it made. Cute patent Mary Jane shoes. And my mother would curl my hair, just like Shirley Temple's. And then I took tap lessons, and I learned to tap on the good ship Lollipop. Life was good. Life was so good. Then when I was a teenager, things changed a little bit for me because I couldn't change my dad's no's to yes's. There was something about boys. He'd tell me I wasn't old enough. And I think I was about 16 before I had my first real date. And we went to the picture show, and the gal... Now, I want to tell you, growing up in a small town in southern Oklahoma has its perks. But when the gal that runs the picture show knows you, and you sit in there with your boyfriend, she spies on you. And if you go to the show without a date and you sit by the boys, she calls your daddy. That's not so good. But life was good. And World War II happened. You already know how old I am, so World War II did happen when I was alive. And I can remember things changed in that town. A lot of faces were missing. I was 12. And I didn't realize the horrors of war. I can remember one Sunday afternoon, I was on a piano recital, and one of the ladies there received word that her son was killed And I can remember how the town surrounded her and how everyone was there for her in her grief. And I grew up in this small town surrounded by love and caring people. Now, when I was about 16, I had a friend who was a freshman at the University of Oklahoma, and she asked me to come spend the weekend with her. Well, I was delighted to do that because I was going to see the college boys, and my daddy wouldn't know anything about it. In fact, she had a blind date for me. And the veterans were back. They were all back in school. And there was one in particular that she was attracted to, I'll say. So she wanted him in the crowd and invited him to go along and escort me that evening. Well, you know, I was kind of a planner and dreamer. And I thought about the kind of guy I'd like to meet someday. There he stood. Tweed coat. Argyle socks. Pipe. Fraternity pin. I knew he was studying for a profession. He fit everything I wanted. He spent the evening telling me how he won the war. And and I believed him. And he had a flask in his hip pocket. And I thought that was really sophisticated. I'd been to the movies. And we danced. And it was wonderful. And I thought, what will he do when he takes me to the door? He kissed me on the cheek. Now, I'm going to tell this. I used to tell it and not get the groans that I get today. But he gave me a nickel, and he told me to call him when I became of age. Well, I thought that was a compliment then. So I kept that darn nickel, and my folks sent me to a girls' school, and it came in handy. But Cleve and I did start dating my sophomore year in college and his senior year in law school. He lived in Waurika. Now, this is 10 miles from where I grew up, and the college kids would all get together during the holidays and party. And this was December of 1948, and we married in June of 1949. A planner and a dreamer I was. And he suggested a fall wedding after he was admitted to the bar. And I said, no, I want to be a June bride. And I was. Life was good. Everything I planned and dreamed was coming true. So we started our life together in Norman. He was taking some classes that summer, some tax law. And he taught me to drink beer that summer. Now, we didn't have much money, and at the end of the month, we could get a six-pack, or at the beginning of the month, we could get a six-pack, and I had one, and he had five. And I didn't think that was strange. He liked it better than I did. And it just didn't do for me what it did for him. In fact, alcohol was kind of a fun part of it all. And I thought he just got cuter. God, we could dance. Life was good. After he finished the courses, we went back to Waurika and stayed while he studied for the bar. Now, his dad had been in business there. In fact, his great-grandfather started the business before statehood. And he was sort of expected to come into this with a law degree. And I kind of wanted to get out there. So he accepted a job with the Department of Interior, and we lived in Tulsa for a while. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. But we stayed in Waurika until he passed the bar. And that was the only bar he passed for some time to come. And after a year in Tulsa, it was really a fun life up there because a lot of his fraternity brothers were from there. And partying was fun. Life was good. And I could never, I just couldn't see where alcohol would ever, ever be a problem for us. After a year, Cleve came in one day and he said, you know what? I would really like to go back to my part of the Oklahoma, hang out a shingle and practice law. Well, I was ready for this now. And I said, okay. And the town welcomed us. My gosh, the church, the business organizations. And here was another young couple moving back to Warrica. A lot of veterans did then. They went home. And it was a great little town. Oklahoma was dry and we had lots of bring-your-own-bottle parties. Cleve was appointed judge. And then we had access to all the confiscated hooch in the sheriff's vault. Life was good and life was fun. The only thing that I had planned and dreamed to happen that wasn't coming true was a child. And I can remember the disappointment I would have. And I can remember the round of doctors that we went to. And finally, one old doctor sat me down, and he said, Nell, in all probability, you'll never bear a child. Now, here was a big no in my life. And the God of my understanding, I had been told, was my Heavenly Father. And I thought, if he's half as good as my daddy, I've got it made. And I prayed to this God of my understanding, and I thought he said no. And I've learned all these years since that God's no is simply a prelude to a much better yes in my life. And I hope I tell you about all these better yeses because they're there. And I'm not afraid of the word no anymore. Cleve came in one day and he said, there's a little six-year-old boy that needs a home. Let's go see him. I said, I don't want a six-year-old boy. I want a baby. He said, oh, come on, let's just go see him. I said, okay. We knocked on the door and this little bitty guy came to the door. I said, hi, Mike. And he looked up and he said, how'd you know my name? And I knew he was mine. I knew he was mine. He climbed up in my lap, and he said, you're my third mother and the goodest one I ever had. God, I wanted to be the goodest mother he ever had. His mother died of alcoholism. His dad had a little bout with the bottle and a second wife. She had left. And I just made a decision. I said, Cleve, we're not going to drink anymore. Well, he looked like I'd struck him. And he paused and he said, I'll tell you what. I won't drink in front of the boy. And that satisfied me. I thought that'd be good enough. But things started happening then that were totally different than had gone on before. He came in drunk a lot. I have no idea when alcoholism starts. But as the disease was manifesting itself in him, it was manifesting itself in me. And I was blaming him, just like Larsine said last night. And I can remember how my feelings changed. I can remember fear had never been a big part of my life. Anger had never been a big part of my life. Revenge had never been a part of my life. And all of that was changing for me. When I didn't know where he was, I panicked. So he became the hunted and I became the hunter. I started looking for bottles. And he started winding up in jail. And I was embarrassed and I was humiliated. I want to tell you something. If any of you are still living with a practicing alcoholic and you do not live in a small town, move. Society will condone your every action. And I'll tell you about that. 3 years after we adopted Mike, I got a call one day from a doctor friend of ours, and he said, "Nell, I have a baby girl for you if you want her." Just like I planned, just like I dreamed, that I'd get a call someday about a baby girl. So I went to Cleve, and I told him about the phone call. And he said, I want that little girl more than anything, but you have got to promise me, if we get her, that you'll quit drinking so much. He said, "Why, Nell, that baby is just what we need. I'm going out of public office into private practice." He said, "I'll be rid of some of the pressure I'm under, and I promise you, honey, things are going to change." And we got in the car and drove several hundred miles and picked up a little baby girl. She weighed 3.5 pounds. She was 6 weeks old. We named her Rebecca. One more time, I thought life was good. I thought all of my plans, all of my dreams finally would come true. I had a little boy and I had a little girl. And I had a husband who promised me that things were going to change. He didn't lie. They got worse. You know, I love our literature, the little pamphlet that says, "A merry-go-round called alcoholism." I love that thing. I identify with that thing. Our old merry-go-round went faster and faster, and I couldn't get off. I didn't know what to do. And I told you that people do find out. They find out what's going on in your house. They find out that your husband is drunk. They find out that he's been in jail. That created a whole new role for me. I went to town without makeup because you look more pitiful that way. And I'd walk up and down all 2 blocks of Main Street of Warwick, Oklahoma, and I'd hear them say, "God love her. Bless her heart." And I just love that. God, finally. And I'd go in and invariably somebody would put their arm around me and say, "How do you stand it?" And I'd say, "I don't know." But you know, that wasn't my answer. And I soon got tireder of their pity. I didn't want their pity. But I didn't know what to do. I went to my doctor. I went to my minister. They would answer my questions with questions. And they'd say, "How do you stand it and why do you stay? Why do you stay?" I'll tell you why I stayed. I became emotionally dependent on him to fulfill all my neurotic needs. And if he had sobered up, I would have gone stark, raving, mad. I wouldn't have known what to do with those feelings. I had a whipping post as long as he was drunk. I needed that whipping post because that justified how I thought and how I felt. We had a couple in Warwick who were attending AA and Al-Anon in Wichita Falls. I didn't know anything about Al-Anon at the time. Cleve was in the DA's office then. And he wasn't back there yet, excuse me. But they came to him and asked him to go to his first birthday party. It was a classmate of his. And he came home and, he was back in the DA's office because he told us that he would go because he felt like that he needed to go and kind of see what an alcoholic was like, because he did have several come through the jail there. And we went to that first meeting. And I can remember I liked it, but when I heard some of the stories, I just didn't know whether Cleve was one of them or not, because I didn't think he was quite that bad. We kept going, though. Occasionally, Cleve would go back with him. And I started going because I realized that Cleve was not paying any attention. And what the speakers were saying was really good, so I memorized that. Cleve clipped his fingernails, and so I had to tell him what the talk was about all the way home. Nothing was working, though. Absolutely nothing was working. And one day Agnes called and said, "How would you like to go to Al-Anon?" And I told her I'd go. I really kind of thought it was the auxiliary for AA, and that maybe I could learn something there. Their husbands were all sober, and I was pretty good at baking cookies if they needed that. So I went to that meeting, and I walked in that room, and the people were smiling, and I liked that. I was kind of tired of those old sourpuss faces of Warrica, and I smiled back, and I realized they hadn't heard what I was going through, so I proceeded to tell them, and the woman in charge of the program that night suggested that we get back on track and mentioned something about their program and the steps on the wall, and then there'd be a lull, and I'd jump back in because there was something else that they surely needed to know about me and why I was there. And again, they smiled at me and talked about their program. They talked a lot about those steps on the wall, and finally I looked at those old steps, and I picked number 12 because it said something about carrying the message. And I thought, this is the training program that you go to learn how to get them sober, and I was hooked. I was going back, and I did from that day on. I kept going back. But I'm going to tell you something that I felt in that room that night, and it took me a long time to really discover what it was. It was a feeling beyond my circumstances, a vision beyond my circumstances. And unknowing to me, that was what I wanted. I wanted what they had. And I went back time and time again. I gathered up all the literature in the AA room and took it home, tastefully decorated the house with it. Cleve didn't read it, so I read it to him. Early in the morning, I never was a morning person, but I'd get up while he had coffee, and I'd take one of those pamphlets, and I would say, I knew he hadn't read it because, you see, I didn't dust that table where I put it. And that little clean spot never changed. And I can remember the first time I was, and I read emotionally because I knew it was good literature. And Cleve would kind of choke and sputter, and I thought he was getting emotional, and I just kept reading, you know. But that didn't work either. That didn't work either. We'd met a great couple in Wichita Falls. And I love their names because they're really good Texas names, Ruby D. and Carney. Now, they had moved from Wichita Falls to a little Oklahoma town just east of us, but they still went to meetings in Wichita Falls, but frequently they came by to see us. I loved it when they came by. There was something different about their visit, and I'll tell you what it was. They loved Cleve. I was really kind of tired of people not loving Cleve. But they loved him. And they'd come in, and drunk or sober, they stayed. And I knew there was something different about that. Cleve Steve knew there was something different about that. But one day they came by. I had a rocker. This rocker was in the living room, and I positioned it where I could look out the front door. And I was pitiful in that rocker. I rocked Rebecca because I thought that made you look more pitiful. If somebody came up, you know, on the steps and looked in, especially if they came in and said, "Nell, how are you?" I just rocked that kid. Have a tear running down one cheek. And I'd say, "Not good." And then I could tell them what was wrong. And that particular afternoon, Ruby Dee and Carney came by. And I was in my rocker. And I had that tear running down one cheek. And Carney said, "What's wrong?" I said, "Well, Cleve's in jail. And he's just humiliated all of us." And he stopped me. And he said, "Nell, there isn't anything you can tell me about Cleve that I don't already know, honey. You see, Cleve's an alcoholic. Nell, what's your problem?" And you know, I heard what he said that day. And I believe to this day that God put those words in his mouth and granted me the ability to hear, finally. "Nell, what is your problem?" And I'd been with you long enough that I knew what my answer was. I had listened. I just didn't want to believe what you said. I didn't want to believe that this program was for me, because that meant I had to change. Finally, I was ready to change. And I cried out to the God of my understanding, and I said, "God, I've tried to help you, but you didn't listen. So I'm gonna give Cleve to you." You see, when I was a little girl, and I was mad at my mother, and if she had spanked me, I would get in her closet and cry and blow my nose on her dresses. You know, when I did an inventory, I found out that was revenge. And I really kind of thought I got even with God when I gave Cleve to him. But God does strange things with our prayers, doesn't he? And two weeks after I gave him to God, Cleve had his last drink. Now that's briefly, what it was like, what I was like, and what happened. You know, I still like to think about what happened. I still like to think about that feeling that I had when I knew that the vision that I'd caught in the rooms of Al-Anon was there for me. And I was really a little bit relieved that I didn't have to read to him anymore. I had a lot to do. I didn't want to mess with him if I was going to finally take care of me. What a guy he was. We started going to meetings. Now, Warrika did not have a group, and we traveled 4 and 5 nights a week to a meeting within a 100-mile radius of Warrika. Some were 25 miles away. Some were 100 miles away. But we were in those meetings. And you know, the guys would call and see if there was an Al-Anon meeting that night. Or they would see if it was an open meeting so they could take us. Al-Anon is a family disease. And Al-Anon and alcohol, the disease, I mean, alcoholism is a family disease. And the cure, the recovery, I believe has to be in both the alcoholic and the Al-Anon. I don't think that I could have had forgiveness without this program. There were things I hung on to because I had to blame him for something. And I thought about these things occasionally when he didn't say or do the right thing and reminded him of them. You know, that didn't bother him, but it sure bothered me. And I can remember when I knew that the need was there for complete forgiveness. And I keep this thing pasted in my Odette that says, "He who cannot forgive others breaks the bridge over which he himself must cross if he would ever stand in need of forgiveness himself." I had to forgive. And I can remember when I asked his forgiveness, and he told me that he couldn't even remember what I was talking about. But you see, a good relationship and forgiveness, that all goes hand in hand. I don't think you can have one without the other. And the years of his illness proved that to me. Because we knew how to treat one another, he was not full of self-pity. And I did not feel put upon for having been able to care for him. And his last words to me were this: "Can you think of anybody that would have been better to me than you have?" And I said, "Absolutely not." You see, I didn't know. I didn't know that would be our last conversation. And I'm glad. I'm glad now. I felt sad about it for a while. But that's just the way it should have been. I spent most of the years of his illness trying to make him laugh, trying to make him feel good about himself, that he was not a burden. And I can remember I would walk in the mornings and I would take him a cup of coffee and I'd say, "My name is Nell. And today, I'll be serving you." One morning I went in, took him his coffee, plunked it down, didn't say a word. He said, "Young lady, you didn't tell me your name." I said, "I know." But because of this program, acceptance. Sure, I miss him. He would have 50 years in May if he were living. I hate to think about the celebration where he is. Won't it be great? You know, our kids turned out pretty good. Mike is retired from the Navy. He lives 10 miles south. He's the guy that can do anything. He can repair anything. And he's working at Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas. And he drives through every day and he'll stop, "Do you need anything?" He picks up Keurig coffee for me at the base because it's cheaper. Sometimes he just calls to see how I am. You know what he says? He says that I'm the goodest mother in the world. Yeah. Rebecca has been everything a girl should be. A pain in the neck. She had her dad twisted around her little finger, just like girls are supposed to do. But I'll tell you, she's my go-to gal. She helps me immensely with a lot of paperwork and all of the things that I need a little encouragement to do, like my living will. No, I'm teasing about that. But she reminds me of things that will make it easier. And I'm grateful for that. Very grateful for that. Now, you remember I told you that I prayed for a baby. I believe in God's timing more than anything. Because at the age of 39, I got pregnant. Cleve was a few years sober, and everyone realized I'd let him back in the bedroom. And and you see, God had a baby for me that I wouldn't have been ready for a few years ago. I just wouldn't have been ready for that baby. Chris was born December the 7th, 1968. And Christopher has Down syndrome. And I can remember my heartbreak. That wasn't what I planned, and that wasn't what I dreamed. But in a very short time, Cleve and I knew, after a lot of prayers, that we wouldn't change a thing about him. He's unconditional love. He's a little saint in a lot of ways. We were in a restaurant not too long ago, and two gals came in. We were in the town of Ringling. They have a real good steakhouse there, and some of us had driven over to eat that night. And a couple of gals came in, and they both looked a little rough, like they might be getting ready to enter these rooms. And one of them was on a walker. Now, we didn't pay any attention to this, and I didn't think Christopher did, but when we started to check out, Christopher was at their table, and I heard him say to the young lady who needed assistance with the walker, "Are you okay?" And she said, "Yeah, I'm okay." He said, "Well, let's pray." And I thought, "Oh," and I kind of looked down, and then I kind of looked around in the restaurant, and everyone had bowed their head. Yeah. You know, I can remember when Cleve would go out the door in the mornings, and I'd be scared. He wore black when he drank, black suit, black bow tie, black boots, black colored glasses. He'd get in the car, and I'd think, well, if anything happens to him, he's dressed for it. But I saw this man love this little boy. And I saw him proudly take him to town. We took him to AA meetings. We took him to conferences. Cliff Roach is his sponsor. He never registers as an Alateen or Al-Anon. He says, "I'm alcohol," writes his name. And oh, the Christopher stories. And I'll tell you why they're wonderful. They're what this program has taught me. And I want to tell you about a gift he gave me. When he was about 6, he sat alone. 9 months, he sat alone. And I had him on my lap. And I was thinking how grateful I was that he sat alone. See, they don't give you a chart when these kids are born, telling you what to expect and when. Sometimes they tell you this will never happen, but we never believed any of that stuff. All we ever did was motivate him and help him and love him. And he did things. He did things. And that day he sat alone. And I held him on my lap, and I thanked God. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me, as I looked at this baby, these so-called physical imperfections, and I knew, for the very first time, how much God loved me, just the way I am, just like I love Christopher, with all these so-called imperfections. And God loves me just like that. You know what? God is just as glad when I make a little progress. My progress is pretty slow. That's why I keep coming back to these rooms. I want to hear more. You know, our spiritual growth is dependent on constant fulfillment. And this is where I get it. This is where I find it, in these rooms with people like you. And this little boy taught me that. A little guy they call retarded. I watched him the other night at Good Friday services. He went in and he sat down in front of me. And sometimes he prefers a pretty blonde, kind of like Lori, you know. And he sat with this cute blonde and looked back at me and smiled. And as the music started, he looked up. We were in a Protestant church. He looked up and he crossed himself. And during the last hymn, which was, "Were You There When They Crucified My Lord?" he got a little Pentecostal and he started raising his arms. When it was over, he turned to a friend and he said, "My daddy's my angel, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost." So you see, he gets it. Somehow, he's getting it. I wouldn't trade him. I wouldn't change him. And you know, that's what this program tells us. We don't change anyone else. We learn acceptance. Acceptance is not resignation. I can tell you that. In acceptance, there's trust. There's a difference in hope and expectations. And that is the trust I've come to know. No, I wouldn't change him. I wouldn't change anything that's happened because it got me where I am today. I'm a little more forgetful, yeah, but that's okay. I can accept me where I am. Most of my situations, whether it's good health or bad health, I can accept it. Because you see, I have that loving God that that little boy truly taught me about. And I know, I have the help I need because it's expressed to me through people like you, even people like Jason. Now, I forgot to mention Jason. Jason and Cliff took me to eat the other night, and the girls were doing something with their hair. And they said, "Where would you like to eat?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know. I'm fine. I've been on kind of a diet. And not to lose weight, but for other reasons." But anyway, he said, "Well, there's this and there's this." And then he pointed to one. And I said, that looks good. And he said, "Well, you would choose the most expensive one." So I've got to talk to him before we go. I know I can't change him. I'll tell you something that was sent to me. But this is another thing I'd like to tell you. Larsine's mother made a beautiful cross-stitched thing for me about a handicapped child. And it's absolutely beautiful. And I've got it hanging where when I wake up in the morning, that's the first thing I see. And I still love it. I was given lots of things to read about a disabled child. And one of my favorites is one called "Welcome to Holland." And it goes like this, and I tell it to you for the simple reason. It was written about a mother raising a child with disabilities, but it's also about life. So I'm going to close with this. Having a baby or living life is much like planning a trip to Italy. You read everything you can read on the things that you're going to see, and you check into the climate and what kind of clothes you're going to need, and you get so excited. And the big day arrives, and you pack. And you get on the plane, and you think about all of the wonders of the world. And you fly, and you fly. And after several hours, the flight attendant comes up as you are landing, and she says, "Welcome to Holland." And I look up and I say, "I'm not going to Holland. I'm going to Italy." She says, "I'm sorry. This is where you get off." And I say, "I can't get off here. I'm going to Italy. I've read all about it. That's where I'm going." And she gently takes me by the arm and leads me to the door. And on the way, she says to me, "I think you'll like it. The pace is a little slower. It's a little different. But I think you'll like it." And oh my. I hope you find what I found when you land in Holland. And we all do. We all land in Holland. I have a wonderful travel agent. I call him God. I have tour guides that you would not imagine. I call them sponsors. I call them people like you. I call them the ones I've heard this weekend. You've brought me a message that will certainly brighten my world and make me realize that Holland has windmills and Holland has tulips. Holland has a beauty all its own. I can't thank you enough.